An immediate and unconditional ceasefire must be the first step to ending the war. But right now, we see zero indication that Russia is ready for a ceasefire. Russia is not winding down its military machine, but ramping it up. We still need to get from a situation where Russia pretends to negotiate to a situation where they need to negotiate.
And that was Kaya Kallas just hours ago, earlier this morning from European time. And that tells you all you need to know about why this whole diplomatic dance that's going on right now, whether it was the 28-point peace plan or the alleged 19 points, which I have still not seen, has resulted from that, or any comments in any meetings that may take place later this week or this coming week, following week in Moscow, where President Trump said he's going to send Witkoff to talk with Putin again. Right now, there is no chance that this is going to result in anything. This is going to be probably something like what happened in Anchorage, Alaska this past summer, when there was a lot of hope that maybe something could break through and you had the meeting of the heads of state and maybe they could come to an agreement that could break the logjam. And nothing at all happened. And the same reason that nothing happened then is one of the same reasons that nothing's going to happen this time. Because prior to that operation, there had not been all of the hard, nitty-gritty grunt work done diplomatically between working level folks, so that when the heads of state got together, the thing was almost all the way done, and all they had to do was fine-tune it at the top and then come with an agreement. Both sides would have had to, prior to that Alaska meeting, would have had to come up to pretty much a solid agreement on all the things so that they could then just tie the bow off in the big photo op. That didn't happen, of course, because none of the hard work had been done. And all of the hard issues that didn't get resolved prior to that were still evident at the time. It's like you have all these rocks in the water there and you want to just smooth and sail into a port because that's where you want to dock, but you didn't do any of the hard work to actually make it something where the ship could be brought in. That's why Anchorage, Alaska failed, and that's why this one isn't going to fail, because even though that President Trump had been working on this 28-point peace plan, allegedly, reportedly anyway, without Ukraine, and with Russia at Kirill Dmitriev level, between Witkoff and Dmitriev, it's what's been reported, and not at the official level. Russia has several times said, both Putin and Lavrov and Maria Zakharova has said, we have not talked to anyone at the official level. So all these negotiations were taking place, kind of what they call track two situations. But the problem is, you weren't doing track two with Ukraine or with Europe. And so these guys, as you just saw Kallas there, have not moved one inch from where they were prior to this meeting, where they were in Alaska, where they were prior to Alaska. They are literally oblivious to anything that's going on there, and they have not moved at all. So whatever Trump is doing, whatever he hopes to accomplish, whatever, even if he was talking to the Russians at the official level, you're not making any progress because the other side is anchored full with Ukraine and Europe very much opposing anything that the President Trump wants to get done, anything that the Russians want to get done. And that's kind of odd, too, because as we're going to see in throughout the course of this episode here, President Trump is aware of some of the issues that we talk about on this show of where the genuine roadblocks are and why the European position is untenable, why the Ukraine position is untenable. You can want a settlement that's beneficial to you all day long, but if you can't compel the other side to adopt it, then your opinions are irrelevant. And if you hold on to those opinions, you may find yourself crushed and destroyed on those very rocks that still exist. Let's take a look at that. So first of all, just last night, President Trump aboard Air Force One was asked a lot of questions about Ukraine. And one of the first things he talked about was that there may be a meeting in Moscow next week.
What's the next step?
They're going to keep talking. They're talking to Russia now. Steve Witkoff is going over, maybe with Jared. I'm not sure about Jared going, but he's involved in the process. Smart guy. And they're going to be meeting with President Putin, I believe, next week in Moscow.
Next week in Moscow?
I think so, yes.
So, okay, that's fine as far as it goes. I mean, I'm an advocate of talking. If you're not talking to people, then you don't even have the possibility of negotiated settlement. But what good is it going to do for Witkoff to go and talk to Putin again? And I think they've already talked five times, so I guess this would be number six or seven. We're not really sure how many visits there have been. Apparently, there have been some that weren't reported. But whatever the number is, it's quite a few. But what good is that going to do if Witkoff, and I don't know why Jared Kushner was being involved with this. He hasn't been involved with this from the beginning, and now all of a sudden here he's being injected at this kind of late stage. I'm not sure what he brings to the table. But be that as may, whatever, he's on the team, apparently, might go to Moscow. But if Steve Witkoff doesn't have in his pocket some kind of an agreement from Volodymyr Zelensky and from the European Union, what is he going to have to offer Russia? Because the one possibility is if Witkoff, with President Trump's authority, can say, listen, whatever we agree to, that's what we're going to, that's what the United States is going to adopt. Meaning that if Europe and Ukraine don't get on board, then y'all figure it out. Now, if Trump was willing to do that, and he implied, actually has implied several times since he was inaugurated in office in January, they've implied several times that's what they would do, and they have yet to follow through on that one time. If this is another of the times they don't follow through, and Trump just talks to Russia again, but doesn't have that in his pocket and isn't willing to do his part of just saying we're going to walk away, then this is going to be another Anchorage, Alaska. It's going to be a big diplomatic flurry, lots of headlines and people talking and a lot of meetings and press conferences and all that. But at the end of the day, at the end of the process, it will be exactly where it was at the beginning of the process, exactly where it is right now, which is Russia methodically moving forward on the battlefield and towards conquering Ukraine. That's the bottom line. That's where it's headed. That's where we are in the process right now. And there's no evidence that anything has changed that would alter those dynamics. So with that being an understanding of where we are, let's take a look at where people are at the moment, what they're saying. So President Trump continued on in that press conference talking about some of the acknowledged difficulties.
Well, they're talking about going land both ways and trying to clean up a border. You know, you can't go through the middle of a house. You can't go through the middle of a highway. So they're trying to work something. It's a complicated process. Doesn't go that quickly.
See, what worries me about his comments there, what he's saying is, if this was close to being finished, if this was like 95% of the way there, and now then they're that last 5%, which is really difficult. It's always difficult. But that last 5% is, all right, well, where are the lines going to be? You know, we've agreed on the major issues, and now we're just trying to figure out where the boundary is going to be, because you can't split a city in half, you can't cut a highway in half, all those things he just said there. That implies he thinks that we're nearly at the end. But evidence that what the other protagonists are saying indicates that none of the major issues have been settled. So my worry is that Trump may be thinking, all right, we're looking at this last 5% over here without realizing that none of the last, like, say, 42% has been resolved and is still sitting out there preventing you from even getting to that point where you can talk about the finer nuances here. So that by itself is a problem. And I want to go back to the Anchorage, Alaska issue. There's a reason why I bring that up, because it's very keenly on the mind of the Russian side as well. Sergey Lavrov, a couple of days in the process of talking about this 28 and now allegedly 19-point peace plan, he was saying, you know, I thought we've already addressed this issue. And I thought that in our previous conversations with the United States in Alaska, we made our position pretty clear.
Our assessment remains valid in the sense that the key provisions of Trump's plan are based on the understandings reached in Anchorage at the Russian-American summit in August of this year. And these principles are generally reflected in the plan, which we welcomed. President Putin mentioned this because after Anchorage, when we thought these understandings had already been formalized, there was a long pause. And now the pause has been interrupted by the introduction of this document. We have it, but it has not been officially transmitted to us through unofficial channels. But we are naturally ready, as the president said, to discuss specific wording, because a number of issues there, of course, require clarification.
Yeah, so a number of issues require clarification. Now, as he said, we're going back. I thought we had a deal in Alaska. Now, remember, in Alaska, some of the things that the Russian side said was, we're reiterating what we said the previous June, of June 2024. That's the terms that Putin laid out. And there, just real quick recap, That is the administrative orders of all four of the oblasts that Russia annexed in 2022 would be returned to Russia. And that means Zaporizhia, Kherson, Luhansk, and Donetsk, all of the administrative borders, some of which in all four of those Ukraine still has control over, even Luhansk, which is like 98% or something. There's still a little bit there. Other than the rest of it, though, in Donetsk, there's still a significant portion. And then, of course, Zaporizhia and Kherson, there's a lot that's in the Ukraine control. They would have to willingly walk away from that. There would have to be demilitarization. There was to be a small number, somewhere around 85,000 was the number that was broached earlier in the process by the Russian side for the Ukraine armed forces afterwards. There would be a denazification, whereas the mentality that went into starting this whole conflict from the Russian perspective would have to be taken care of, too. And that would almost certainly mean no Zelensky. None of the Azov Brigade folks would be allowed to stay in power, etc. Then, of course, there would be neutrality, military neutrality for Ukraine, for whatever was left of it. And above all, no NATO. Those were the points that Russia entered the Alaska meeting last August saying, I thought we had an understanding. And from the readout, the Russians reiterated that they did make those points very clear in Alaska. And so it's curious also when President Trump has many times since that point said, I thought five times we had a deal with Russia after that. I thought we had something knocked out. Well, apparently so did Russia. They also thought they had a deal based on an understanding of the June 2024 conditions. And so now when Lavrov makes that last statement there of, well, we just have to clarify positions, I think that they're right where they have always been, which is the June 2024 terms. And they're going to say, where are you on those now? Because we haven't moved. We're still very firmly seated where we were at here. Now, on the other side of this dynamic, in the European and the Ukrainian side, they have mostly not moved. But if they moved anywhere, they've moved away from it. You saw that first comment there by Kaya Kallas at the outset. That was today, folks. And this is not something from the archives or so. That was from today, literally hours ago as we're making this video. And she says, we haven't seen any movement at all on an unconditional ceasefire. And the Russians are acting like they don't want one. The Russians aren't acting like anything, my friend. They are openly declaring that an unconditional ceasefire isn't even possible. It's not even something they're going to contemplate. And why would they? Because they have all the dynamics on their side. They have the balance of power on their side, and they have the military momentum on their side. It would be foolish to the highest degree for any force in any time in history under these circumstances to have an unconditional ceasefire that would only benefit their adversaries. It would be foolish. No one would do that. We would never, under any circumstances, have an unconditional ceasefire from a position of military superiority to any opponent, period. So I don't know why we suddenly think that it's going to happen in the other way. And maybe they don't. Maybe they don't actually think that, but they just want to say that for the Western audience to make it look like Russia is the stick in the mud here. They're the problem. We're willing to negotiate. We're trying to get this. It's so reasonable what we're asking. You have this negotiated settlement first. You have this ceasefire, unconditional ceasefire first, and then you can talk about coming of the more thornier issues. That sounds reasonable. And to somebody who doesn't understand diplomacy or balance of power, they may go, yeah, that's right. Now, they can fool the people, a large portion of them, and they can make people say, yeah, that is right. You stick to your guns. That'll work for them. But you know who it won't work for, though? It won't work for the men fighting at the front line. It's going to continue to move to the West. It's going to continue to move with more Ukrainian bodies being created, more Ukrainian graves being dug. That's the reality of it. And if you think that it's just Kaya Kallas, unfortunately it's not, because here is Emmanuel Macron, the leader of France, adding another problem to it.
We are clearly at a crucial juncture. Negotiations are getting a new impetus, and we should seize this momentum, not because there is reason for alarm, Ukraine is solid, Russia is slow, and Europe is steadfast, but because there is finally a chance to make real progress toward a good peace. But the absolute condition for a good peace is a set of very robust security guarantees, and not paper guarantees. Ukraine has had its share of promises that were shattered by successive Russian aggressions, and real, rock-solid guarantees are a necessity.
real. Rock-solid guarantees are a necessity. He said, we see this momentum for peace. We should seize this momentum. Good on you there. I was in agreement with you until you started talking about the next sentence. And we want these rock-solid guarantees. That is a complete non-negotiable for Russia. They also will not contemplate that because that gets back to the June 2024 deal to have a neutral and demilitarized Ukraine. That's just their position. You can hate their position. You can adamantly dislike it and disagree with it and come up with a whole paper of reasons why that's not sustainable and that won't help peace and whatever. That's your opinion. Problem is, we don't have, as the collective West and Ukraine all together, and that includes the United States and Europe, we don't have the military capacity to compel compliance on that issue from the Russian side. They have the ability to compel compliance from their perspective and what they want, which is not only no guarantees, but also no viable military beyond just basically basic security for the Ukraine side. Little more than police state. Internal security is what 85,000 will get you. And that's it. And you can hate that. And that's fine if you want to, especially if you're Ukrainian. I would hate it if it was my country that was being imposed upon. There's no question about it. But in the reality of on the ground, it matters what you can do and what you can't do. And we cannot compel that on the Russian side. They can compel on us their vision. So you see that whether it's seeking an unconditional ceasefire that we would never acknowledge and accomplish under the circumstances, but we're trying to get the Russian side to do it, or that's trying to get these conditions on top of the Russians that we know that they won't agree to, you're basically, not basically, you're directly setting up standards on the Western side that guarantees there won't be a settlement. The guarantees that all this stuff that Trump is doing with this first 28 points and now down to somewhere pound 19, which is not just a reduction from what we've read anyway, in the, you know, from 28 to 19, but also whatever has survived out of the 19 is different than what it was in the 28, which is, by the way, going to be even more advantageous to the Ukraine side and more disadvantageous to the Russian side. And as we saw, the Russians weren't happy at all with the 28 points. They sure aren't going to be happy with the 19 points, which means that all of this negotiation from the Western side is making peace less likely. So it is literally undermining what President Trump said he's trying to do and trying to send Witkoff to Russia next week on here. Now, it could be that some of the reasons why for this recalcitrance on the European side is that they say, hey, the Russian economy is suffering some. They have some real problems. And it turns out that that's not entirely unreasonable because there actually are some economic problems on the Russian side. That's not an incomplete threat on the or made up claim on the Western side. This is Russian media here. This was translated by Google Translate. So this is Russian media that's talking about here. And it says, at present, the state of manufacturing industry is increasingly influenced by internal market conditions, including cooling demand and rising cost of borrowed capital. At the moment, we see a significant slowdown in the manufacturing industry as a whole. In January, September 2025, the growth rate was 2.9% compared to the same time in 2024. So far, we still have vehicles, finished metal products, radio, electronics, good results in pharmaceuticals and other industries. Unfortunately, their number is increasing. There is a negative trend. Interesting, though, let's just kind of take a look at that in context here. The growth rate was 2.9%. So they're concerned that the growth is slowing down, but it's still at 2.9%. I guarantee you, there is not a country in Europe that would not love to have that slowdown to 2.9%. I think that the most, many of them are at 1 point something percent, just anemic growth. And there are many countries in Europe that have no growth or even negative. So they're in real trouble there. And perhaps that the Europeans are saying, you know what, man, we see those numbers. There is a negative trend. The Russians acknowledge there's a negative trend. Let's keep that going. We've had 19 rounds of sanctions. Let's pop another one on there. You never know. Maybe this will be the straw that breaks the camel's back. Well, in that same analysis, they continued on. It says, as we've already noted, the main threat to the Russian economy now is not sanctions, The country has learned to cope with such problems. The fall in domestic demand is what greatly cripples domestic business. The same now is now being said in the Ministry of Industry and Trade. So what they're saying there is that it's not the sanctions that are having the problem. These are internal things, that the rate of borrowing money. They have inflation. They're trying to bring that under control, and they're pulling lots of levers or so. And it's just, so far it's not working very good, and it is causing a slowdown in their economy. But it's not the sanctions. Now, you may say, well, that's just a hyperbole. That's just what the Russians are saying. But really, it really is this situation. Well, I think that most likely that is a true statement. And here's why. We have had, with not just these 19 rounds of sanctions, plus the last one by the Trump administration, so basically 20 overall, and they're apparently working on a 21st one, but all the sanctions that have happened from 2014 up to the 2022, and there was a ton of them, huge number of sanctions on Russia from 2014. We have made them almost sanction-proof now. We just don't have any more levers to pull that make any difference, because the reason why is that some of the earlier sanctions were really biting and really did hurt. And then a new round, and the first ones in 2022 were a significant damage to the Russian economy. But what it caused them to do was to retool and to reorient to the East and to elsewhere in the global South, et cetera, to go more into the BRICS direction and all those kind of different difficulties. They found a way around them. They found a way to retool so that they are no longer dependent on the West. So now then, when you want to bring in a Western sanction, it falls flat, because now then their economy is built elsewhere. Whereas there was problems earlier, it caused harm, but it didn't cause any depletion and destruction. It just caused difficulty. And man, if anyone has ever studied Russian history, and I'm talking through centuries, the Russian people know how to suffer. They're not used to always having everything good for them, and they'll go crazy if things don't work out exactly the way they want to, like we in the West do. We have gotten, especially in the United States specifically, since World War II, and really in the Western world since the beginning of the 20th century, we've kind of gotten into this lap of luxury kind of mentality that everything always works out the way we want, and we'll just buy our way into whatever we want, and eventually it usually works. Yeah, we had the Great Depression. We had some serious problems here and there, and the dip of 2008, the dot-com bubble, a bunch of stuff. Periodically, there's dips, but we always recover quickly, relatively quickly, and then we usually go on this big growth rate. We're used to that always working here. So when things do go down, we get mad, and we want somebody to change it. And we just imagine that Russia will be the same way. And if we just make it difficult enough for them, they'll turn against their leader, Vladimir Putin, and somehow that will cause him to withdraw from the war. That is a ridiculous idea that is just historically absurd and not sustainable. Even less so when you look at the actual economic fundamentals that go into the Russian economy as a result of our failed policies with overuse of sanctions. See, sanctions are only useful, and they can be useful if used like a skillful surgeon's knife, if you put some sanctions on that hurt something specific with the intent that to change some policies, and then if those policies change the way you want, you pull them back off. See, if you have a system that says, hey, this is something that's going to hurt you, but it doesn't have to, if you can do this thing, which is maybe you have to hold your nose a little bit, but it's not that bad, and that you can win otherwise. And then you see that by accommodating that and doing what was asked for, then you can benefit from it. If that kind of a system existed, then sanctions could potentially be useful if used sparingly and strategically. We don't have any of that. No nuance, just like bulldozer top. Just throw them all on there and just one right after the other, oblivious to what you have created on the other side, which is basically an immunity to what we're doing here. So now in this idea of 20 or 62 rounds, I mean, just keep going ad infinitum. That's what we're going to end up with because of what we've had. So we don't have those levers. But that hasn't gotten into the Western mentality. We still seem to think that, no, we can. We'll say, look, that one economic indicator there means that we're succeeding. So let's just keep on going with everything we want, and eventually it'll work. And we're just setting ourselves up for failure. Because I promise you, Russians will find a way to work through this economic issues, just like we try to on our own domestic economies, et cetera. And there's no evidence that this downturn is going to cause a collapse that would in any way cause the Russians to take these actions that we want them to in the West. Well, that doesn't seem to matter much, even to not just the Europeans, even to some Americans. Here is a retired Army General, Barry McCaffrey, who prior to this round of the 19 here, even found the 28 points really upsetting and not pro-Ukraine enough.
It clearly prohibits European Union peacekeeping forces. It caps the size of the Ukrainian military, which, of course, is no threat to Russia, a much smaller country. It prevents Ukraine from having long-range weapons. And then finally, it clearly supports aggression by Putin by telling them they have to give up territory in the Donbas that's still in their hands. Ukraine's in a very vulnerable position right now. They have a corruption scandal going, which is difficult for Zelensky to deal with internally. And in addition, the Europeans were not consulted on all this, nor essentially was Ukraine. So I don't see where this is going. Putin's a dictator, a thug. He murders his own people. It's been a disaster for the Russian economy. Hard to see how this has a positive outcome in the short run.
Yeah, I mean, and when all else fails, go back to the tried and true demonization. Just say that he's Hitler incarnate. He's the devil. He's wicked. He's evil. That darn Putin. Yeah, so forget about all the fundamentals. Forget about all the facts. Just go back to the emotional issue. He's Putin. Therefore, that trumps anything reality. That trumps any of the fundamentals we've talked about here. He's evil, so let's keep going with it. And it's ironic. He's talking about how, oh, I don't like those because how bad for Ukraine that it would cap this at that time, 600,000. That's what was the 28 point. That's one of the things we know about the 19 point was now they want to cap it at 800,000. And as a means of comparison, prior to this war, Ukraine had about 286,000. And so now then, apparently almost triple that number was insufficient and inadequate. So now then they want to say, well, let's just toss another 200,000 on there. And that's what we'll agree to. Why wouldn't the Russians agree to that? Obviously, that's ridiculous. But he's talking about how it's unacceptable to the Ukraine side to have any limitations on it and oblivious of the fact that it's also not acceptable to the Russians to have a fraction of that number here. But here's getting into some of their more difficult stuff in the complicated and the unexplainable portions. As I talk all the time, war is about men, not machines, not about money. You got to have machines and you got to have money. But without men, it don't matter how much of the other two categories you have. That's a general truism throughout human history and the armed conflict. It's about men, not machines. Now, it appears that the United States actually understands that. Here was an odd statement. We'll start, first of all, with U.S. Ambassador to NATO, Whitaker, who was talking about some of these details and some of these plans. He's going to acknowledge here that there is a Russian advantage in the military capacity, but look at his odd conclusion.
Neither side is going to get what they want. And we don't know until we have a deal that's hammered out who's giving up what. I mean, certainly the Russians have a stronger position on the battlefield. You know, they're making small tactical gains every, week. But, right. You know, that's not how the rules-based order works. And ultimately, you know, unless Europe and the United States decide to, you know, take a different tack, this is where we end up.
Hang on. At least as I see that, you can kind of see on his face as the words are coming out of his mouth, he's kind of thinking, oh, snap, I can't go down this path because this doesn't work. He's talking about, sure, Russia is making these tactical gains. They're small, but they're every week and they're moving forward. And you can see him struggling, like, what am I going to say now? Because I just basically laid the foundation for why we can't get what we want because the Russians have the manpower. They have it. And instead, he says that's just not how the rules-based system works. Okay. That's a little more illustrative than it may appear here because that shows you that this mentality is baked in. No, no, no. We are the dominant force. We have, especially since the Soviet Union fell and we won the Cold War. And now then, perpetuity into the future forever. We're now in the dominant position, and that's the only way it can ever be. So no one else can ever rise. We can never shrink. We will always be the dominant power. So we set the rules-based order. Note that he says rules-based, not law-based, because law is theoretically anyway applies to everyone. But the rules, on the other hand, are set by the dominant force. So whoever has the power sets the rules. We have the power, we set the rules, and that means that we can set one set of rules for you and a separate set of rules for us, which can be completely contradictory, and there's no problem with that because we have power. So I can tell you that you can't change another country's borders by force, and then I'll do it left and right. I can tell you that you can't commit genocide, and then I'll support it without a second thought to it, etc. That's the rules. And to our way of thinking, that's fine. There's no problem with any of that. We can have completely contradictory policies as long as you understand the rules are we get to do what we want and you do what we tell you to do. That's what he thinks. And so that's just not how the rules-based system works. No, that's how reality works, Mr. Ambassador, that the side with the power can compel compliance on the other side. Now, when we have a world where that's the only thing that works, we have real problems here. And that's when you have violence and bloodshed and no justice. And that's what we acknowledge was part of what happened. One of the big reasons why we had World War II was because that was raining on the earth. And it was violent and bloody, and millions of people paid with their lives, and countries were wiped from the map and replaced, and rules change or borders change, etc. That's not a way to live. That's one of the reasons we had the United Nations afterwards, and at least the theory and the concept that we wanted to have a more just and noble world that had morality. That's the reason why we said all those things there, and for at least a period of time, nominally, we kind of tried to adopt that, even though it was never, even from the very beginning, all the way followed. And it we clearly had things behind the surface and all kinds of things we did bad. I'm not going to relitigate all those things, only to acknowledge I know that they've always existed. But at least in part, in theory, we tried to adopt this better ideas. Now then, we have, especially since the end of the Cold War, and in the last 4 years, we've just gone full on, I don't even care about it anymore. Now it's just the rules base. Our rules, sucks to be you if you're not. Only that's the problem, is that this isn't 1991 anymore. That worked in 1991. At the end of the Cold War, China was still basically had a peasant army. They had not retooled. They had not modernized any of that stuff. The Soviet Union was in disarray. The whole Russian empire had gone away. The Russian Federation was a rusty hulk, basically. Their economy was in shambles. Their government was just as corrupt as the day is long, etc. And we were the shining city on a hill and the most untouchable power. And we got in our mind that we don't have to worry about this whole thing about trying to have justice and a fair world and an order that everybody follows the same set of rules and justice and any of that kind of stuff. We said, actually, we have the power to compel anything we want on anyone, and we're going to do it. And then we always tried to put the words onto paper over what we were doing to me sound like we were still doing things that were equitable and just. Now that we don't even do that. Now it's just, no, this is the way we're going to do. And so now then you see that all these leaders at all the high levels, to include the ambassador to Kaya Kallas, Emmanuel Macron, Keir Starmer, all these people, they grew up in this system, and now that's the only way they can think. They don't know how to adjust to the fact that now then there is a China with power here. There is a Russian Federation with power here. They're no longer impotent, and we can no longer do what we did before, but we don't seem to be following that path. And it's curious because you saw Ambassador Whitaker there acknowledge that Russia does have the advantage in manpower. It turns out that the U.S. Army Secretary Dan Driscoll went to Kiev here not long ago and apparently told the Ukrainian side, you have an imminent defeat if you don't agree to our plans here. It's almost like he'd been watching our show, or at least he'd been looking at reality on the ground and said, and what's being reported by NBC here is that he went there and told them, you've got to make a deal, because if you don't have enough manpower. You can't avoid defeat. Now, why Ambassador Whitaker said that, I don't know. But also last night, President Trump acknowledged that same dynamic.
Well, I think, look, this war could go on for years. And Russia's got a lot more people and a lot more soldiers. So I think if Ukraine can make a deal, it's a good thing. I think it's great for both. Frankly, I think it's great for both. But Ukraine's got a, you know, it's a much smaller group of people. They've lost a lot of people. Russia's lost a lot of people. But Russia has a much bigger pool of people.
I mean, I can't put it any better than what he just said. Ukraine is smaller. Russia's bigger. Russia has a lot larger pool of men. So if war is about men, not machines, not money, then Russia's going to win because they have the men. Trump just admitted it, but they also have the money and they have the machines. So they got an advantage in all of them. There's no course left. Rationally, there is no course left for the Ukraine side. The only thing that's logical and moral is for the Western European side, for the Ukraine side, and for the American side to say, folks, we did the best we could. We gave it our best shot. We gave it years to work here. Ukraine is a smoldering wreck right now, but there still is a Ukraine. Russia still hasn't gone beyond that, whatever, 20-21% of the country here. They aren't to the Dnieper River, et cetera. Let's make this deal now with these five or four oblasts, five counting Crimea, and call it a day. And we're going to limit the amount of force. We're going to do all the things we have to do to get this off the table. An ugly deal that's going to be bad for Ukraine. They're not going to like any of it. But it's the only thing that we can do. This is how you save more of Ukraine. This is how you make sure instead of four oblasts, it's not eight oblasts. This is the way you do that. If you pursue with this idea that the rules-based order doesn't work this way, and we want security guarantees, and we're going to keep fighting no matter what, and the Russians are, you can keep saying all that, and you will see the territory continue to shrink until one day you've seen all this slow moving stuff. But as a reiteration, Russia's objective is not primarily territory. It's primarily the destruction of the Ukrainian armed forces. And once that gets down to some unknown point here, no matter how brave and courageous and heroic the Ukrainians have fought, no matter how much skill their fighters have had, there comes up to a point where there just isn't the fabric left and it breaks. No one ever knows where that is. I thought it might have happened before, but no one can predict it. It's in history. You look back, sometimes it comes with just a few cuts and a few negative trends, and then the whole thing collapses. And then other times, like the Nazis in World War II, they never break until they're just finally crushed to literal dust in Berlin. So sometimes it works that way, but that's how it's going to work. There's either going to be a sudden collapse or there's going to be a complete ground to dust that may take a period of time. Trump may be right on that too. It could be years, but it could also be a handful of months. We don't even know, but it's inevitable that it'll be one of those two things. And to continue to pretend otherwise is just ignores reality. And let me leave you with this one. There's one guy who does not have any problem understanding what reality is, and that's the guy who's on the other side of this equation, Vladimir Putin.
But we have our own tasks, our own goals. The main one is the unconditional achievement of the objectives of the special military operation and the fulfillment of the tasks that our fatherland and the people of Russia set before us. The people of Russia are counting on us, counting on you, and expecting the result the country needs.
Look, if anybody is any confusion on where Russia is, that one soundbite right there shows you all you need to know. There's Putin in his military uniform in front of his biggest military commanders, who are the ones that are moving, as Ambassador Whitaker acknowledged, moving to the West. And who apparently Dan Driscoll acknowledged has the manpower, the industrial capacity, and the money to continue this indefinitely. That's what was in that NBC article, said that apparently he acknowledged that they can go on like this indefinitely. The Ukraine side can't. So it's great that the president is going to send Steve Witkoff to Moscow, maybe to meet with Russia as soon as next week. Terrific. But that's meaningless, just like the Alaska trip was meaningless if it's not followed with action on the Western side. And as we showed you at the outset of this video, there's no evidence that anybody with power in the West, especially Europe and in Ukraine, are ready to acknowledge the realities and take reasonable, logical, moral action to save the rest of Ukraine. So it looks like that they're going to condemn Ukraine to death, not to difficulties, but to death. And that will be the narrative that will echo through time. That's the legacy that they're leaving to Europe and to Ukraine, is that their unwillingness to acknowledge reality condemned Ukraine to death, when just rational thought could have saved much, much more long time ago, and hundreds of thousands of men would be alive to this day. And hundreds of thousands more probably who are alive today won't be at the end. That's just the truth of it. Before I let you go today, one other thing I do want to talk about, because it's something also in the news here today, and President Trump also mentioned something about that last night, and that is this whole Venezuela issue. President Trump was asked, what is it you're trying to get done with Venezuela? Because I've told you already, there's plenty of a lot of combat power, a lot of firepower that has been, by some accounts, in more than a generation since that much firepower in the Americas, U.S. firepower was in this region of the world, and it's now massing just offside of Venezuela. There's been a couple of B-52 trial runs that could mimic an actual attack here, which could come at any time. And, you know, these rehearsals sometimes are indistinguishable from the real thing until the last minute when they drop bombs. President Trump was asked about that last night.
On Venezuela, sir, are you planning to talk to Nicolas Maduro?
I might talk to him. We'll see, but we're discussing that with the different staffs. We might talk. What Venezuela?
Maduro, the U.S. Designated him the leader of this foreign terrorist organization. Why do you want to talk to him if he's the leader?
Well, if we can save lives, if we can do things the easy way, that's fine. And if we have to do it the hard way, that's fine, too.
Mr. President, do you have any reaction?
I'm not going to tell you what the goal is. You should probably know what the goal is, but they've caused a lot of problems. And they've sent millions of people into our country. They were probably the biggest abuser with Tren de Aragua and all the others that they sent in, the drug dealers, the drug lords, the people that they sent in, the jailbirds. They opened their jails and prisons and dumped them into the United States. And we're not happy about it.
You know, what's part of the problem there is that, as that headline showing there, you know, Trump says we can do it the easy way or the hard way. And immediately after that, he was asked, what is the goal of this? And he says, I'm not going to tell you the goal. And when I first heard that, I went, what do you mean you're not going to tell us the goal? See, that's one of the problems that I have, and I've been warning about for a long time, kind of an imperial presidency, and the consequence of having a situation where we don't follow the Constitution, where we ignore our own laws, which prohibit the president of the United States from attacking into a foreign country without express congressional declaration of war, an express congressional authorization for military force, or that we were first attacked, our armed forces or our country was attacked by this force. That's the only three things that are allowed. Otherwise, the Constitution says only the Congress can take the United States into war. And if you attack another country, that is by definition an act of war. But that by saying, okay, remember Lindsey Graham? I've shown you a few times where he just kind of rolled his eyes and said, you know, I don't remember the number. He said like 136 times or 130 times that we violated that law. No one cares. So who cares if there's 131? This is what matters here. Because now then we have a situation where the president of the United States is at the precipice of attacking another country, possibly to dethrone and depose the leader, because somebody we don't like. And when asked why, just the reason, what are you trying to accomplish? I ain't telling you. And no one batted an eyelash. No one even thought, wait a minute, what do you mean you're not going to tell us? Of course, that's what a democracy is. That's what this transparency that the president, his administration always brags about themselves, the most transparent in history, except that when it comes to war and peace, we're not going to tell you anything, but we're going to have our military power there. That's the exact opposite of transparency. There's no reality to that claim at all. And now then you see it's this growing impetus, impunity. I don't care what you think. I don't care what the law says. I don't care anything. I only care what I'm going to do. And I've got my reasons and you don't need to know. I'll take care of it when it is. And then he throws some stuff out there about, you know, drug dealers and you know, people that come into the United States and allegedly emptying jails out. All that's just trash noise. There's no, number one, even if all of it were true to some degree or another, That does not authorize or justify military action, period. There are other ways to handle that kind of stuff. It doesn't, just because you don't like policies some guys do, you can't go kill them. Well, at least in the world that I used to know, the one that should still exist. But now then, instead of us pointing to these people, you know, around the world and these leaders out there that are going to use military power in unethical and immoral ways where might makes right, that we've always decried, now we're the ones that are doing that. You can't deny it. You may not like it. You may feel uncomfortable with that title being applied to us. Or tell me I'm wrong. Argue with me and tell me that that's not the case. When we are sitting there, a president of the United States, you saw with your own eyes, said, when asked, what is the objective? What is the goal? I'm not going to tell you. You should know. Okay, well, I'm left to guess. And I would guess you just don't like Maduro. You have power. You feel no constraints. So you're going to go kill him. Am I right? You said you should know. That's what I think. Is that right? Is that what you're telling the American people? Is that what you're telling the global public? New sheriff in town. And now then, there aren't any rules except for the ones I make. And if you don't like it, to hell with you. Get out of the way or die. Is that the kind of country that we want? Is that the kind of country we want? Folks, listen to me. It's not just an unethical. It's not just an ugly thing. It's not just immoral even, though that should be enough. This is the very character and nature of who our country is becoming. And when you see the leaders acting like this, and I've observed this all over the place, then you see, you know, the second level leaders, and then the third level beyond that. And then even now some of the rank and file folks in the country, they're adopting that same kind of language. And now then it's like, yeah, kill them all. I see that a lot in social media commentary. And from, you know, members of Congress or so-called experts when they're talking on these various networks. That's what they're saying, too. Nobody seems to have a problem with it. All the while, we want to say, yes, we're a Christian nation, and we follow Jesus Christ. We read the Bible, and we are the good guys. They're the bad guys. You still keep having that same language on top of us, and it's just mocked by most of the people in the world these days, folks. And it engenders fear in others, and not the respectful kind of fear, but the fear that says, I'm going to take action to protect myself and undermine the United States whenever I get the chance. So they're actively looking at ways out of fear, fearing that there could be the next one. And if you take out Maduro here, who's to say that you're not going to take out the leader of any other country that we happen to run afoul from tomorrow? So everyone is going to be afraid of us, and they'll be looking. Many of these other countries that aren't going to be powerful enough to do anything will have every incentive in the world to look to the east, to look to China, to move into their orbit, to move into the Russian orbit. Anybody that has the chance, because we're not going to attack China. We're not going to attack Russia because they're too powerful. They have nuclear weapons, and they have conventional forces that are also very powerful. So you're giving multiple countries around the world motive and incentive to move out of our orbit, to move away from the dollar. This even affects us economically. All these things are negative consequences to our actions here. This is a much, much bigger deal than we think. Folks, it ain't 1991 anymore. And unfortunately, in 1991, we got away with a lot of stuff we shouldn't have. And we got used to doing things the wrong way. And now then that the conditions have changed, we don't know how to reorient our brain. We don't know how to retrain our thought process. And all of our leaders grew up in that environment where they don't have to worry about anybody else, but now they do. And if we keep going down this path here, it's going to end ugly for us. Don't know how, don't know when, but the just human nature being what it is, and then the arc of history being what it has been for millennia, our number will be called, and it will be our fault. We will have earned what is to come. Good news is we're not there yet. And even though we are going in a really bad direction, the worst hasn't happened yet. So there is still time to turn from it. So as we're making this video today on the, I think it's the 26th of November. So one day before Thanksgiving, we still have the chance as of today to check this slide, to stop doing things that are immoral, unethical, and illegal. We can start doing things that just don't make sense. We can stop doing all those things and start turning the ship around. And unfortunately, that has to start at the top, and I don't see a lot of evidence the president's going to do it. But if more people speak out, we're doing what we can here on this channel. You can help us out by sharing this with other folks. You can like and subscribe to this channel. Those things help more than you may think. Pass this around to other people, because the more people that have this same kind of thought process and the same values and the same beliefs, the more we can find and put pressure on. The people still do have the capacity. We've seen it even in recent days in both Europe and the United States even. The people can still affect what the leaders do. So we are not without agency here, and we should do everything we can while we still have a chance to get this ship right for our own sakes and for our posterity, so that our kids have a chance to live in something good like we grew up in here. That's where we're at. And I'm thankful for that opportunity. And so we look forward to seeing you guys. We're going to do at least one show. I know a lot of our audience here is not in the United States. And so tomorrow's just a Thursday for them. It's a holiday here in the United States, but we will have a show for you tomorrow. So we look forward to seeing you then on the Daniel Davis Deep Dive.